Now, as we continue in our study of 1 Kings, the northern kingdom of Israel has just hit the bottom of a spiritual death spiral. The 10 tribes have a new king whose first prominent action was to renounce the God of Israel, who at the time was being represented by two golden calf idols that King Jeroboam had manufactured, and replaced Jehovah God with Baal. Baal was the god of King Ahab's new wife, Jezebel, who was a native of Sidon and Tyre. Now, we need to keep her home nation in mind this evening because it plays a kind of a hidden role in one of the biblical narratives that we're going to examine. 1 Kings chapter 17 introduces us to one of the greatest men in the entire Bible, Eliyahu, or better known in Christian circles as Elijah, the prophet. The story of Eliyahu covers the next three chapters in 1 Kings, and then it picks up again early in the book of 2 Kings. He is so important that Christ invokes Elijah's name on more than one occasion. And later Old Testament prophets like Malachi also speaks about him. Malachi is, he's known in English. It's likely that Elijah himself is going to play, I think, a key role during the future period that the church calls the Great Tribulation. And we'll talk about that and the terminology later. But tonight we're going to begin to discuss Elijah quite extensively because God chose to use this strange man very mightily and entrust him with divine power to perform miracles that in some ways exceeded that of Moses. So with that, let's read together 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 391. chapter 17. Eliyahu from Tishbe, an inhabitant of Gilead, said to Ahab, "As Adonai, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there will be neither rain nor dew in the years ahead unless I say so." And then the word of Adonai came to him, "Leave here, turn to the east, hide in the Wadi Kurit near the Yarden, the Jordan. You are to drink from the stream, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there." So he went, and he acted according to the word of Adonai. He went and lived in the Wadi Kurit near the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the stream. And after a while, the stream dried up because there was no rain in the land. Then this word of Adonai came to him, "Get up, go to Sarfat, a village in Sidon, and there, and live there, and I have ordered a widow there to provide for you." So he set out and he went to Sarfat. And on reaching the gate of the city, he saw a widow there gathering sticks, and he called out to her, "Please bring a little water and a container for me to drink." And as she was going to get it, he called after her, "Please bring me a piece of bread in your hand." And she answered, "As Adonai your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a pot, a little oil in the jug. Here I am gathering a couple of sticks of wood, so that I can go and cook it for myself and my son. After we have eaten that, we will die." Eliyahu said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go, do what you said. But first, use a little of it to make me a small loaf of bread and bring it out to me. After that, make food for yourself and your son. For this is what Adonai, the God of Israel, says. The pot of meal will not get used up, nor will there fail to be oil in the jug until the day Adonai sends rain down on the land. She went and acted according to what Elijah had said, and she, he, and her household had food to eat for a long time. The pot of meal did not get used up, nor did there fail to be oil in the jug, in fulfillment of the word of Adonai spoken through Eliyahu. A while later, the son of the woman whose house it was fell ill. His illness grew increasingly serious until his breathing stopped. She said to Eliyahu, "What do you have against me, you man of God? Did you come to me just to remind me how sinful I am by killing my son?" "Give me your son," he said to her. Taking him from her lap, he carried him into the room upstairs where he was staying, and he laid him on his own bed. And then he cried out to Adonai, "Adonai, my God, have you brought this misery on the widow I'm staying with by killing her son?" And he stretched himself out onto the child three times, and he cried out to Adonai, "Adonai, my God, please let this child's soul come back into him." Adonai heard Elijah's cry. The child's soul came back into him, and he revived. Eliyahu took the child and brought him down from the upstairs room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son's alive." And the woman replied to Eliyahu, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of Adonai that you speak is the truth." This mysterious man, Eliyahu, simply bursts onto the scene out of nowhere. There is no genealogy given for him. There is no account of how he came to be a prophet of Jehovah. There is no life history, kind of like it was with Samuel, for instance. We know nothing of this man's earlier life. And even though some mention of where he came from is recorded, it's very general. It's ambiguous at that. Now, we're told that he's from a place called Tishbe, but he is also an inhabitant of Gilead. Scholars have different takes on what that might mean. The most accepted is that his birthplace is the town of Tishbe, located in the Upper Galilee region in the territory of the tribe of Naphtali, but that at some point he must have immigrated across the Jordan River to Gilead for some unstated reason. Further, there is never a mention of his tribe. In fact, a handful of later scholars took the radical approach that since his Israelite tribe wasn't given, that he wasn't even a Hebrew, that he must have been a Gentile. That wouldn't fit the context of the story whatsoever, and is, frankly, a replacement theology agenda-driven fabrication that serious scholars of all kinds have dismissed out of hand. Some Jewish Torah scholars say that he was a Benjamite. Others say he was of the tribe of Gad, which would explain him residing in Gilead. That was the land of Gad. Others insist he was a Levite. Many of the early church fathers agreed he was a Levite, and so does the Jewish Kabbalistic literature of later times say that. I'm pretty much in agreement with those early church fathers that he was a Levite, because it was typical, very typical, for a Levite to be born in one place, but eventually to move to someplace else where he could serve God. Also because in the next chapter that speaks of his war against the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, this is where he performs a sacrifice. And he did so without an intermediary. In other words, he did so without a priest. Only Levite priests can perform sacrifices. And it is highly doubtful to me that the Lord himself would order Elijah to sacrifice on an altar if Elijah wasn't a priest of proper lineage. But that's my take on it. Now, for a reason not given to us in the scriptures, our first glimpse of Eliyahu has him confronting King Ahab, probably at his palace in Samaria, Shomron. And Elijah is threatening the king with a warning that he's going to bottle up the skies And not only stop the needed rainfall, but he's going to also keep dew from forming on the ground. Further, that until Elijah orders it to begin again, no moisture for growing crops, for filling the rivers and the streams is going to happen. Now, Hebrew tradition is that Eliyahu used this occasion of the death of Hiel's two sons to come to the king's palace to bring God's oracle to him. In the previous chapter, we see that someone named Hiel volunteered to rebuild the destroyed city of Jericho, even in the face of a divinely ordained curse upon anybody who would attempt it. Jericho had laid in ruins until now, since Israel had first crossed that Jordan River, led by Joshua, and God laid that wicked Canaanite city to waste. Hiel did it anyway. And of course, God acted accordingly by carrying out the consequence of the curse and seeing to the death of two of Hiel's sons. Now, no doubt it was the apostate king Ahav who put Hiel up to this misguided construction project. And so the ancient Hebrew sages say that upon Hiel's sons' deaths, Ahav felt obligated to have the funeral at his palace in Shomron, Samaria. And it was at this somber event that Elijah arrived to pay his respects. Is that actually the case? I can't say with certainty, but the circumstances easily accommodate that viewpoint. And there's no reason to simply dismiss it because it's not written in the Bible. Now, this explanation is first recorded well before the time of Christ, so it has veracity. The only reason I even offer it is because, as I've taught you in prior lessons, you know, there are always reasons and causes behind all the actions of these Bible characters. All these reasons and causes were, at least to them, logical, rational, in tune with societal customs and traditions of their era. The authors and editors of the books of the Bible didn't usually include such details because to the audience they thought they were writing on behalf of, these details were generally common knowledge. If today, in one of my lessons, for instance, I said I drove from Cocoa Beach, Florida, to New York City, I wouldn't have to explain to my listeners that I used an automobile or that I had to purchase gasoline to fuel it or that I drove on roads paved with asphalt and concrete. This is just common knowledge to us. It's laughable that we'd have to explain it to anybody. But 1,000 years from now, these details just might be needed to help establish the context. Now, Eliyahu's threat to King Ahav is interesting on a couple of fronts. First of all, because it is but an application of the divine threat issued in Moses' day in Deuteronomy 11, 16, and 17. There it says, "But be careful not to let yourselves be seduced so that you turn aside, serving other gods and worshiping them. If you do, the anger of Adonai will blaze up against you. He will shut up the sky so that there will be no rain. The ground will not yield its produce, and you will quickly pass away from the good land that Adonai is giving to you." Now, the second front is that Elijah made it clear that he could, on his own authority, make the decision to shut up the skies and then to reopen them again. And as we're going to see, this is not an idle boast, because that is what actually happened. Of course, it was the Lord who directed him to do this, and this power was on loan from God to perform this miracle. But this is the first indication we have of just how great and an unparalleled career as a prophet that God intended for Elijah. And third is the matter of the dew. Now, dew is more than just a pretty decoration that shimmers on the plant leaves and slightly dampens the soil. Dew in an arid climate is often critical in keeping crop plants watered and viable, especially at times when no rain was falling. So the lack of both dew and rain indicated something of a catastrophic nature was about to happen that was bound to cause famine and death. Now, interestingly, this matter of a prophet being given the divine authority and the power to stop the rain from falling is going to repeat itself far into the future. The only difference is that Elijah stopped the rain on a relatively localized area. Oh my, but this future prophet of the latter days, we're told, is going to stop the rain worldwide. That's a scary thought. Listen to this passage in Revelation chapter 11:3-6. Also, I will give power to my two witnesses. They will prophesy for 1,260 days dressed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two menorahs standing before the Lord of the earth. If anyone tries to do them harm, fire comes out of their mouths and consumes their enemies. Yes, if anyone tries to harm them, that's how he must die. They have the authority to shut up the sky so that no rain falls during the period of their prophesying. Also, they have the authority to turn the waters into blood, to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. So here we see that the Lord is going to give power to stop the rains to a prophet, two of them actually, who are identified as the famed two witnesses of the end times stories, and who appear during the time of the coming of the great tribulation. But what is even more interesting is the identity of these two witnesses. At least one of them becomes identified for us in the book of the prophet of Malachi. Malachi 3:23 and 24. Look, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of Adonai. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers. Otherwise, I will come and strike the land with complete destruction. Look, I will send to you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of Adonai. So what we have here is that Elijah is going to return just before the day of the Lord, the pouring out of God's wrath, the return of Messiah, and we have two witnesses appearing, and they will order the rain to stop during the entire period of their prophesying, which is 3.5 years. But then we have this statement made by Yeshua in Luke 4. Luke 4:24-26. Yes, he said, I tell you, no prophet's accepted in his hometown. It's true. I'm telling you, when Elijah was in Israel, and the sky was sealed off for 3.5 years so that all the land suffered a severe famine, there were many widows, but Elijah was sent to none of them, only to a widow in Zarephath in the land of Sidon. So let's put all this together. We find out from no less than Christ that in 1 Kings, during the reign of King Ahab, Elijah did not permit it to rain for 3.5 years. Next, we find out in Malachi that just before the end, Elijah will return to earth to announce the coming of the end. Then in Revelation, we find out that just before the end, two witnesses will appear and they will stop the rain for 3.5 years. Obviously, one of the two witnesses is Elijah, and he will do in the end times essentially the same thing he did in Ahab's day, which is to stop the rain for 42 months. It's patterns, people. It's patterns. If the God If God is the God who never changes, then neither does his patterns. In fact, it is widely believed, I think it's probably the case, that the other witness is Moses himself. Now notice that another thing that the two witnesses will do in the end times is turn water into blood and call down, it says, every kind of plague. Who does that bring to mind? See, this is what Moses did to Egypt, another pattern. So it seems pretty likely to me, at least. Not with certainty, but it seems likely to me that that other prophet will be Moses. Now, back to our story in 1 Kings 17. Verse 2 says that the Lord told Eliyahu, which literally means El is Yah, or dynamically, God is Jehovah, that now that he has given Ahab the bad news, he needs to flee the vicinity and hide himself. Specifically, he's to go east, and he's to hide in the Wadi Krit near the Jordan River. But did he cross over and go even further east, or did he merely go east from Samaria, staying on the west side of the Jordan? This isn't clear. But most scholars believe he went into the Transjordan area and hid there. This would put him further away from King Ahab and where the king had less influence, and so Elijah would be a lot more difficult to find. Wherever he was hiding, he was to stay away from people. He wasn't to be near any food source. So the Lord commanded the ravens to feed him. Now, to command the ravens means to reprogram their instincts. It means to make what would be unnatural for ravens to do to seem now natural to them. In this case, it was to deliver food morsels fit for a human to Elijah. Now, the later rabbis struggled with this because they felt that the idea of ravens bringing food to Elijah was just too problematic. First of all, it sounds too improbable that ravens would bring edible food to a human being. Second of all, ravens are classified as unclean birds. Would God use an unclean creature to bring sustenance to perhaps the greatest and holiest prophet ever known, especially if he was a Levite priest? And since ravens will eat almost anything, it's unimaginable to the rabbis that the food the ravens delivered would have been kosher. Thus, they decided that since the Hebrew word for ravens is orev, and with a little stretching, it could be interpreted as Arab, and then this would indicate that Arab trade merchants, not scavenger birds, fed Elijah. Now, other rabbis said that the word is meant to designate a nearby town called Orev, which no one's ever heard of. We don't find it anywhere in history. And so the townspeople of this Orev fed him. None of this is satisfactory. And it only seeks to harmonize rabbinic Judaism and its strict rules of kashrut with this biblical passage. That's all that's going on here. The thing is, these Talmudic traditions ignore the intended miraculous nature of ravens feeding Elijah. Even more, one can only imagine how the level and intensity of Elijah's faith and trust in Jehovah must have increased as a result of such an unimaginable miracle. You know, he was going to need the ultimate faith of which a human is capable to do what God had planned for him. So his time in hiding was much more than just waiting. It was preparation. In fact, there is probably a message to Elijah and to us in God's choice of ravens just because they are unclean birds. We're going to see why that is in a moment. Now, of course, Eliyahu would have needed water, so the Lord had him live by a wadi. Now, a wadi is typically a dry riverbed, but not always. It is sometimes a mostly dry riverbed that has a small brook that flows through it during much, if not all, of the year. That's the kind that's being contemplated here. But by being at this brook, when the coming drought took full hold, Elijah would be among the first to know, because it would dry up, be among the first water sources to dry up. And sure enough, in time, verse 7 says that the water course dried up and went underground due to the lack of rain. Now, once the drought had taken hold, and its effects were starting to bear down hard on the people, the Lord told Eliyahu to go to a place called Tzarfat. This was a village in Sidon, the main city in the nation of Tyre. Now, I told you at the beginning of our lesson this evening to watch for this, because Sidon of Tyre was Jezebel's hometown, and it was located within her father Ethbaal's kingdom. Now, Elijah was instructed by God to go and live with a widow who resided in Tzarfat. God had prepared this widow for this purpose, but take notice, this widow was a Gentile woman, And according to Jewish tradition, that would have made her unclean. So naturally, the rabbis couldn't tolerate this prospect. So they decided she wasn't really a Gentile after all, but rather she was the widow of the Jewish prophet Amittai. Even more, she was the mother of the prophet Jonah. Of course, all that is pure fantasy, but boy, it sure seemed to fix all the problems for the rabbis. So Elijah was first fed by unclean birds. Next, he went to live and be fed at the home of a Gentile widow. Now, naturally, this is all indicative of what would be so explosively manifest in Yeshua's day, that Gentiles would be intimately involved in and would be joint beneficiaries with what the Hebrews of God's plan of, along with the Hebrews of God's plan of redemption. Something that the vast bulk of the Jewish leadership could not fathom, let alone accept. But Elijah didn't know who this widow was. And the widow didn't consciously know that she would host God's prophet. So somehow they had to discover one another. Now, when Elijah arrived at the city gates, he saw a widow gathering sticks. And he would have known she was a widow by her widow's garments and understood her condition of poverty by these puny sticks she was gathering to create such a modest cooking fire. Now, he asked her for a drink of water, and she complied. And then he asked her to bring him some bread to eat, and she said she didn't have any. All she had was a very small amount of flour, some ground grain, and a little bit of olive oil. In fact, she explained that once she used the sticks she was gathering to create a small cooking fire, she'd cook the tiny remainder of that flour, and she and her son would eat the resulting bread, and then they'd just starve to death because that was the last of their provisions. She would have had no means to get any more. Now, it wasn't primarily because she was poor that she would starve to death. It was because the drought Elijah called down from heaven affected the weather all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, and that included the nation of Tyre. There was simply no food, except for those who had enough funds to pay exorbitantly for what limited supplies there were, and that leaves a poor widow and her family without. Interestingly, in her reply to Elijah, she says, "As Jehovah your God lives," meaning she knew of the God of Israel. She knew that Elijah was an Israelite. Now, his response to her sets the stage now for another miracle. Tells her not to fear. Go ahead and do as he asked. Bake a small loaf of bread for him to eat. And once he's served, bake more for herself and her son. But, he says, Jehovah God of Israel will reward her for her obedience and her kindness by supernaturally assuring that no matter how much flour she takes out of that little flour jug, it's never going to be empty. At least not until the rains start again, crops begin to grow again, and the nation's food supply is back to normal. She believed Elijah. She did as he asked, and sure enough, she and her family never went hungry during that entire 3.5-year period of the drought. But this also speaks loudly of this Gentile woman as having but the simplest of faith in the word of the Israelite God as spoken by his prophet, and it was sufficient for her to be delivered from death. She gave up the familiar, the comfortable, even the rational and the logical, as well as the certainty of what she had grown up with within her own culture, and she did it all on faith. Faith in the God of Israel. She trusted Jehovah with her and her son's lives. And again, it's critical to grasp this was a Gentile woman. This was not a Hebrew. And now we understand that part of the Lord's preparation of this woman to receive God's prophet and God's word was the faith that the Lord had planted deep within her, unbeknownst to her. What could be a clearer picture of how anyone, especially a Gentile, could become a believer in the Jewish Messiah, Yeshua, beginning 9 centuries into the future? The simplest faith in Messiah was sufficient for deliverance. And it mattered not whether one was a Jew or a Gentile. In fact, let's return for a moment to Luke 4 to see how well what we just studied plays into a teaching of Yeshua. Let's go back again to Luke 4, 24 to 26. Yes, he said, I'm telling you that no prophet is accepted in his hometown. It's true, I'm telling you. When Elijah was in Israel and the sky was sealed off for 3.5 years so that all the land suffered a severe famine, there were many widows, but Elijah was sent to none of them. None of them in the land, only to a widow in Sarfat in the land of Sidon. See, the point of this passage is that God could have sent Elijah to any number of Hebrew widows in the land of Israel. But instead, what did he do? He chose to send him to a Gentile widow in a foreign nation who weren't his people. Why? Because the northern kingdom of Israel was now so perverted and apostate that the greatest prophet of God was not welcome in his own nation. Is that not what we see happen with Yeshua and later on his disciples and apostles? They were welcomed by Gentiles in foreign lands, but they were driven out of synagogues and Jewish villages in the Holy Land. Truly, Elijah was a shadow of things to come on a whole number of levels. But then a terrible thing happens. This faithful widow's son takes ill and he dies. Now, some Christian scholars and rabbis have tried to say that the boy's breathing was merely shallow enough that it couldn't be detected. He wasn't really dead. But that's not true. Saying that his breath left him or that his breathing stopped, that was just a standard saying. It was a Hebraism. It meant he died. It wasn't a technical medical report of his cardiovascular system. The idea that ancient people couldn't tell the difference between shallow breathing and a dead person, well, that's ludicrous. They dealt with death on a far more regular basis and more intimately than any modern person, except maybe for a funeral director in the Western culture, will. The boy was dead, clearly. But then this distraught woman made a startling accusation towards Elijah. She wants to know why Elijah would come to her, accept her kindness, and then bring God's wrath down upon her for her sins. In other words, she was well aware of her sins, but until now, God hadn't been near enough for him to be aware of her sins. Now remember, it was believed then that gods were territorial. Where would the God of Israel have lived? In Israel. Not there, not in Zidon. But now that God's prophet, Eliyahu, was here in Sidon, it drew attention to her and her family. The result was that God saw her sins. Now he's punishing her for her sins by killing her son. Of course, what we're witnessing coming from this woman of simple faith and but little knowledge of, had very little knowledge of God, is pagan thoughts, pardon me, and superstitions so prevalent, so accepted in her day. And this is why I say without ceasing that simple faith is good enough for salvation. But maturing of the believer must commence immediately. Immediately. Or else those carnal and pagan thoughts that we all have, that we all lived in all those days before we knew Messiah, that's going to get all mixed up in God's truth. We must begin to study his word from the beginning in Genesis and apply those practices and teachings to our lives, or we're going to live in the same current condition of this widow in Tzarfat, confused, but certain of what we think to be the truth, even though it's not. Elijah grabs the dead boy. He took him upstairs to his bed. He laid him in it, and in earnest prayer, he asked the Lord if it was he who killed this child, which was the boy's mother's explanation. And then he prayed that the father would return life to this child. Now, we have to remember here that this is far more than merely a sad death of a boy child. Without a son to care for her later in her life, this widow faced the most horrendous of prospects. Thus, for God to kill her son was indeed not a punishment for her in the sense of her experiencing the excruciating loss of this child that she adored, but rather it was dooming her to a life of deprivation and bitterness when she became too old to care for herself and she had no son to watch over her. It also meant an end to her deceased husband's life essence, because it was thought that that permeated through sons. So her torment was far greater than only the sadness of the premature death of an innocent child. As with the case of the man born blind that's mentioned in John chapter 9, the death of the widow's son was not meant as a medium of punishment for this woman's sins. Rather, it was allowed so that the Lord could demonstrate his glory and he could reveal his works through the situation. So Yehovah did something unbelievable. For the first time recorded in the Bible, we have a bodily resurrection from the dead right here. And curiously, think about it. It was a Gentile boy who was raised by the prayers of a Hebrew prophet and the power of the living God of Israel who gave him life. The boy, now back to life, was handed over to his relieved mother. And Elijah, seeking no credit, merely says, "See, your son's alive." By means of this miracle, we see Elijah as a kind of a forerunner of Messiah Yeshua. But we also can imagine the incredible leap of faith that must have occurred not only in the half-heathen woman of Tzarfat who possessed nothing but a mustard seed worth of faith, but also in Eliyahu. And man, he was going to need it, as we're going to find out. This chapter ends with the woman moving from half heathen to fully transformed. She expresses her now implicit faith in Yehovah God of Israel as the true God who speaks only the truth. as the only God who can bring life from the dead. And we will continue with Elijah's adventures next time when we take up chapter 18.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.